And now we're going to hear from our speakers, and this is always so exciting to me. And thank goodness the program before us, the partners in AA, was so wonderful and ran so long afterward with people wanting to talk that I didn't really have time to get nervous because I was just waiting for them to clear the stage. And so it worked out really well. But now that I have the awesome responsibility of introducing these speakers to you, it all descends upon me. And when I came up to the platform, our first speaker said, "Oh, you're Jan from Spokane. Oh, no, you're Jan and Fran from Spokane." And actually, for 38 years, I was Jan and Fran of Spokane, and my husband, Fran, died a little over 2 years ago. I have his picture with me today, though, so he's right up here. We often spoke together, and we got sober together. We had our last drink together and stayed sober for those 38 years. And I haven't spoken that much since his death because I was afraid I couldn't really do it with either justice or without breaking down or something. But I did get to speak in Sini, and that was a great reaction for me. And the people of southeastern New York were so generous and loving and good. And they sent me back to Spokane with the feeling that I could keep speaking, which was good because one of the first things I discovered when I got sober was that I wanted to be a circuit speaker. I thought, that is what I want to do. That looked good to me. I was one of those women who, I've heard other people say, my first year was characterized by what I was like, what happened, and what I wore. And that was really it for me. So when I saw my first circuit speaker, this woman all dressed up talking, I told Fran, that's what I want to do. Now I have to figure out how to start doing that. And he said, no, you can't do that. And I said, well, why? He said, because all you want to talk about is service. And nobody wants to hear that. You know, they want this great drunkologue, and you don't have one. I mean, your drinking was really very boring. And it's true. My drinking was as choreographed as kabuki. I mean, it was like, we sat in the same chairs. We drank out of the same glasses. We had a little table in between us on which were bound issues of the National Geographic, which I would bring home from the library so we could plan our trips around the world. Of course, you know, we could barely get to the liquor store, but we had grand plans. So we would sit there night after night and drink and plan where we were going to go and lie to each other about this and then pass out. And that was night after night after night. In fact, some of you have heard me say that I passed out so often on the bathroom floor that when I would get up to go to work in the morning, I'd have these little creases from the tile on my cheek, which was really bad. You know, you couldn't do that. So I carpeted the bathroom. So it was just squishy nice. Very good. But that was our life until one day when I was working at the library, which I do recommend for practicing alcoholics. It's very quiet, and you can get lost in the stacks. They can never find you. And you can look very important and not talk because the noise is so jarring. But in any case, that's where I was when Fran called and announced that he had called Alcoholics Anonymous and someone was going to come to us that night and talk to us about our drinking. Not with the pronouns, forgot me. Us, our drinking. I was only drinking because I was the perfect wife and because I didn't want him to ever leave and go to a bar. So I created a little bar at home, a little atmosphere, so we could just drink together night after night, year after year. And this had been going on for 12 years. And so I prepared to entertain this person from Alcoholics Anonymous. And some of you are too young, as I look at the audience, to remember, but there was a television show with Loretta Young where she wore a hostess gown. They were usually velvet at the top, tap at the bottom, swish, swish, and she would come swishing into the room. Well, I had one of those. And I thought this was the perfect night to break it out. So I put on my Loretta Young outfit and put the dishes under the bed or wherever they were. I would have put them in the oven, but this was, you know, the truth is, we lived in this place for 6 months before I realized we didn't have an oven. You know, it never came up. But in any case, we put all the dishes away, and in came this man who was to change our lives. And he became our sponsor. He used to talk about the fact that he was going to see someone named Jim. Brad said, don't worry, I didn't give him my real name. And I said, well, did you give him your real address? And he said, well, yeah. So he came to see Jim and whoever, but when I opened the door, a la Loretta Young, he thought to himself, oh, God, two for the price of one. You know? And so I proceeded to entertain him in my most glorious style. And he told us his story, and we laughed and cried, and we had just never heard anything like that. Well, since then, I've heard quite a few drunkologues, and his wasn't that extraordinary. It was just the first time I'd ever heard anyone speak honestly about drinking, and it was so astounding to me. And so when he finished, he stood up, and he set down the big book and the 12 and 12, a few pamphlets. There wasn't that much literature, really, in those days. And he left it all. He said, okay, kids. I mean, we were young at that time. Okay, kids, I'll talk to you tomorrow. And we're like, wait. You know, you don't know anything about us. He said, I know everything about you. I mean, he could look around this tiny little house with nothing, and we'd been married for 12 years, and he could see in our face we were so typically desperate. And so he left, and we spent that night finishing the scotch and the big book about simultaneously. And passed out, and through the grace of Alcoholics Anonymous and a loving higher power, we never had to have a drink again. That was the beginning, January 31st. So that's my story. Now we're going to hear stories from other magical women, and I'm really excited that our first speaker is going to be actually from Sini, the area I talked about, Margarita.
Good afternoon, family. My name is Margaretta, and I am a grateful alcoholic. Woo-ha! Ooh, baby, look at us. Ooh, all cleaned up and looking good. And if we didn't have those name tags, you wouldn't know where we've been. I tell you. Yes. Woo-wee! Alcoholics Anonymous, look what it has done for us, to us. Took a wretch like me and turned me around. And let me just share one of the miracles that happened this morning. I'm going to the marathon meeting at the York Hotel. I just love that, York Hotel. And I'm going there to get the 9 a.m. meeting. I'm going up the escalator, and I'm not quite sure where I'm going, and this good-looking guy is coming down. Now, you know, I'm minding my business because I haven't been in AA for a while. So I said, you know, good morning. And as he's going down, he said, you're going in the wrong direction. Now, I'm thinking, well, maybe I'm going in the wrong direction. I said, why? He said, because I'm going down. Now, baby, 18 years ago, I would have turned back around. But because of Alcoholics Anonymous, I didn't even respond, and that is a miracle. You can't tell me Alcoholics Anonymous don't work. All we have to do is keep the plug in the jug. Keep the plug in the jug and keep showing up and be willing to change. But you know what? As long as we keep coming, I found out, you're going to change, or you're going to crack up. No getting around it. You got to change, or you're going crazy. Right here without a drink. So it's better to be sane without a drink. You know what I mean? Because it works better that way. As I said, my name is Margaret, and I am a grateful alcoholic. And my home group is the St. Nicholas Group of Alcoholics Anonymous in New York City and Harlem. My home group is 58 years old, and they were there when I got there, and I am so grateful to my home group and all the members of Alcoholics Anonymous throughout the entire world. Because if it wasn't for people like you, keep showing up to keep the doors open and passing on the message of 12 steps and 12 traditions, I would not be here. I would not know what to do when the disease of alcoholism was jumping down my throat. So I thank each and every one of you for my sobriety, because I am you and you are me, and I cannot do it alone. So thank you so much. That applause is for AA. Now, my sobriety day, in case you're interested, is June 5th, 1987. So for 18 years, y'all been showing me how not to pick up that first drink, no matter what's going on in my life, good, bad, or indifferent, and you've been showing me how to keep showing up for the healing that's in the rules of AA. And you know we got healing now. Yeah, and there's a reason why we keep coming back. And the reason why we keep coming back, we hear the same stories, see the same people, one day at a time, every day. And no matter if we come to Toronto, we still hear the same stories with a different face. So something's got to be going on in here. And it's called healing, as far as I'm concerned. Healing is recovery. Recovery is healing. It is learning how not to pick up that first drink. I want to thank my girlfriend from Spokane. Woo-hoo! Fran, you bad, Fran. I've been listening to Fran's tape since the CINE convention in April. I had it. I didn't see her, but I got the tape and I heard her. I've been playing Fran. She got a powerful message. She had me laughing and rolling in my house. Ooh, Fran from Spokane. I was just going through the house. Oh, Fran, you bad. And that's because Fran has kept the plug in the jug and is passing on the message of recovery. And I need people like her to show me how to stay sober. And my friend over there, Yolanda, who's looking absolutely fabulous. You go, Yolanda. Next time I'll wear my do. You can believe that. A friend that I just met and a friend that I haven't heard and I'm looking forward to hear. And as I always say, you know, I always like to say that I was not a falling down drunk, but I was starting to do some mighty strange things standing up. Okay? I was the Black Marilyn Monroe type. Oh, God. Woo! Hot, steamy, voluptuous, crazy. The only thing that mattered to me was what I thought you thought about me. Now, you know that's sick. You know I belong here. I was the type of drunk that snuck in my own house and snuck back out. Okay? I was married with children, but, you know, I was too busy putting on mascara to really be bothered with those little details of marriage. Because I always had to keep my external going on. And so I had trouble in the household. You know, I was really an embarrassment to the husband and to the children. But I did look fabulous. Oh, God, I look fabulous. I looked fabulous in fur. And I looked fabulous in stiletto heels. I did, and I knew it. And I mean, when I walked out my door, if every man didn't turn around and say, oh, ooh, get it, girl, or what's your name? I thought something was wrong with me. And see why I told you it was a miracle this morning? Because things have changed. I'm telling you, you stay here long enough, you will begin to see the insanity of your ways. At least I did a day at a time. So I had a lot of problems. I was the type of alcoholic to carry my alcohol in a soda bottle because so no one would know that I was drinking. And I was the type of alcoholic. And, well, you know, I don't have to tell you, it wasn't about paying no bills and cleaning no house and all that sort of stuff. It just wasn't. It wasn't to be because I was self-centered, self-absorbed. It was always about me, Her Majesty the Great Me. It was always about me. Now, I was always careful not to let you know I'm always thinking about me. Because, you know, we got to give this image of, no, I'm wonderful. But believe me, I was always just thinking about me. How am I going to do this? How am I going to get that? How is this? I mean, I was the type, I would always eat the last Twinkie. I was selfish. You know, I was just selfish. But you know what? I always had a great smile because, you know, we know how to hone certain skills. And because I always seemed to be so nice. Oh, I played the nice girl act. You know, I was able to get over a lot of different ways. My husband at that time, he used to take the rap, you know, when all the things would go wrong. He would always stick up and, you know, try to take the blame for the wife who's crazy. And so, you know, I've been blessed. And I was blessed that I didn't have a lot of problems with that man because, you know, most men wouldn't put up what I was putting down, you know. But I've been blessed. And I only know that because I come into Alcoholics Anonymous and I've been able to take my inventory a day at a time and I've been reflected through so many of y'all. How I got to Alcoholics Anonymous, well, I don't have to tell you, I was having trouble in my life. I was having trouble on my job. Now, this is what happened. I had one of these jobs, one of these city jobs, where if something happened, you would always have to give up some urine, you know. You had these blood alcohol tests. Oh, God, you know that's real for alcoholics to have a job like that. But, you know, I was the type of drunk I would carry my daughter's urine in my bag just to make sure I was covered. Because I didn't know anything about honesty and integrity or ethics. I didn't understand that because I didn't understand the disease of alcoholism. I didn't know what I was dealing with. All I know is I had an obsession and a compulsion that would not let me be. It had me doing things, well, I don't even have to get into details. You know what I'm talking about. It doesn't matter if all of it was done right in your own home or outside the home. We know the depths and the despair and the disgrace that alcoholism can bring upon us, and particularly and especially as women. But we come to AA, ooh, and all that gets turned around, you know, and our past becomes our greatest asset. So I don't have to feel sorry or regret anything that happened. The past is dead. It's over. It's how I'm living today. That's the only thing that matters. So if you're holding on to any guilt about the days of yesteryear, you might as well let them go and let that be. And you'll taught me that here in Alcoholics Anonymous. So I'm on this job, and I'm carrying my daughter's urine around in order to keep my job. And, oh, my God. And some days I forget to change it and spill in my bag. I'm just a mess. That damn mess. I was a mess. But I look good. I look good. And that's the only thing that matters, that I look good. Finally, you know, your record speaks for yourself. I'm AWOL all the time, you know. I've got problems. I'm being called down. I'm being suspended, you know. Oh, man, just a mess. But I always did it with a smile and things like that, you know. So finally, the authority calls me down to the main headquarters. They want to talk with me on my record. And I remember after they talked with me and, you know, blah, 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 blah. And then they said, Mrs. Samuel, do you have a problem with drinking? Oh, no. Because I really didn't think I had a problem with drinking. Because I didn't drink when I first got up. My husband drank when he first got up. And he shook. I was too cool to shake. I didn't shake. What I like to do is get my other chemistry lab going, get that all swirled around inside of me, and then I would want to start drinking. So when you said alcohol, I said no. But then, see, my alcoholic mind was, they didn't ask me the right question. They didn't ask me if I had a problem with other things. So I lied. And they said, okay. They said, well, we want some urine from you today. Uh-oh, I don't have no urine today. Whoa, hey, wait, whoa, whoa. Okay, the alcoholic mind went into gear. I said, okay. Now, I'm in Brooklyn at the headquarters. My daughter's in school in Manhattan. You know what I did, right? Wait a minute. I'll be right back. I wasn't even supposed to leave that headquarters, but this is how my thing played out. I was able to talk my way out of there, shoot into Manhattan, go to my daughter's school, take her out of class, take her into the bathroom and say, give mommy some pee. That is the disease of alcoholism. When you're that sick, and I was that sick and didn't even know it, I felt some pain of embarrassment and humiliation not towards my daughter, but towards me. But, you know, I just pushed that to the side. So I get this clean urine. And by the way, we have two sons and a daughter, and I only took my daughter's urine because I thought that science and technology can determine if it's male or female. That's how I operated. So I got my daughter's urine. I go back to the headquarters to give up this clean urine. And, of course, the nurse comes in, and they have gotten hit down there. I don't know when they did it, but they've taken all the doors off the stalls now. Can't manipulate the urine. Have to give up my urine, and I knew I was busted. And I'll never forget that day that I had to give up my urine. I'm very grateful for that because I really did exhale. It's over. Because I knew I was busted. It was just a matter of a couple of days before they were going to come and take me out of service. And they did. Humiliated and embarrassed. Oh, I'm so glad now, though. Because if it wasn't for that, I might not be standing here today. So they came. They took me out of service. I didn't do anything. And I was suspended facing dismissal. But I wasn't ready to do anything about my drinking at that point because I just couldn't. What? don't do anything? How does that work? How do you not have something in you to function? How do you not have something in you to clean the house, to make love or talk with people, to interact? And needless to say, none of that was happening anyway. I was not cleaning. I might have been making a lot of noise, but I was not making love, okay? Nothing was working, but the disease of alcoholism had fooled me into believing that I was functioning and could not function without it. So about 3 months passed, and my job contacted me again, and I was ready when they did. They sent me this telegram and for me to come on down to the headquarters to the EAP, Employees Assistance Program, that I had been needed. So I got all dolled up in my black Marilyn Monroe look so no one would know I'm having a problem. And I marched in there with my look on, and I sat down across from this woman counselor, and I love this. She looked me right into my face, and she said, look at all that pain. And the tears just start coming down. That was the beginning. She saw my pain like y'all know my pain. She knew the game. And she was able to say just those words. And next day I was in a detox. I took all my black Marilyn Monroe stuff, you know, to detox. 2 days later, my sister had to bring me some appropriate detox clothing. It's always about image, ladies. We know that. And let me just say, when I went to detox, I was wearing long false fingernails at that time. And I had my glue. So when one breaks, a crack will come off, you know, you glue it back on. Okay. They took my glue, right? So as the nails began to drop off, I began to put Band-Aids around them to hold them on. So I'm walking around with my false nails all Band-Aid on. That was my beginning, ladies. It was the best I could do. But I kept coming. Y'all came into that detox. This is why it's so important to do service. And y'all brought the message of hope. And I knew I was ready. I was ready as only the dying could be. I was so ready because I was sick and tired of being sick and tired, but I didn't know what to do. And I was listening as only the dying does when they're dying. This woman came into the detox, Barbara, my first sponsor, Barbara R., and she told me to meet her at a meeting. I met her at a meeting. When I got out of the detox, though, I went home. My brother was there. He said, you need a pill. I took the pill the day I got out of detox. Then I made this meeting. You don't have to do this. Don't do this. And but this, I don't want to forget that little detail. You know, it's like just a little detail. But it's an important detail. I took this pill of I don't know what, and I went to the meeting. I told this woman, who I asked to be my sponsor, she said, what? You took a pill? We don't take anything here in AA. And from that moment on, it's been one day at a time. So I'm grateful for that. And this woman, Barbara, was fabulous. I mean, she had a little more time than me, but she was like, she used to just take you all around to all the sober functions. And I just, you know, danced my way to staying sober the first year. I didn't bother with the husband, okay, because he was still doing what he had to do. And I mean, the children, all that, y'all told me to keep the focus on me and keep coming back. And now all of a sudden, now that I'm sober, I want to clean that house that hadn't been cleaned and God knows when. I mean, I had dishes on that side of the sink that you never use. I think it was about 3 years. Finally, my sponsor said, why don't you just throw them away? You know, simple stuff like that. Simple stuff, you know, that it does work, right? And I kept coming, and things started getting better. I was moaning and groaning about, I ain't got no money. My son said, listen here now. If you keep coming, you'll figure out what to do with that stuff. All I can tell you is make a meeting, drink some coffee, eat some cookies, and do it one day at a time. Leave that husband alone. And then my sponsor would say, listen now. She came to my house one day. She said, oh, okay. She said, now listen, all I want you to do is clean off one little spot for you to lay down. That's all I want you to do. Don't do no more. Keep it simple. That's enough. And then one day she'd say, okay, you know, maybe you can pick up a banana peel or something. You know, something simple. Nothing too heavy, but keep coming and don't drink. That's the essence of it all. So these are the things that I did, and things began to get better. Yeah, I know, it is hilarious. but I was the type, you know, when I was drinking, that Everything had to appear perfect when I had company. Everything would be upside down, but when I knew company had to come, I would stuff everything like my girl Jan from Spokane under the table, in the closet, push everything on, get my look going on, and then open the door like, enter, you know, well, come in, full of crap all the time, full of it, but didn't even know I was full of it, didn't even know I was a phony until I got to Alcoholics Anonymous and y'all began to straighten me out. You women were fabulous. You've always been fabulous in my life, and I've learned to love y'all. And turn to y'all and bond with y'all. And y'all are no longer my enemy. Check that out. I love to see women looking good and performing well because it works. And so I kept coming, and then I got another sponsor, Peggy. Peggy was a tough broad. She's in Florida now. Peggy would say, listen here, Margaretta. If you're going to make a name for yourself in AA, let it be a good one. And she meant it. She said, don't come in here and be no, well, you know what I mean, with hate. She said, I want you to sit down and keep the maid closed and open up the big book. She was bad. She said, my Greta, I don't sponsor whores, and I don't sponsor women who run around with married men. I said, right on. This is how y'all grab me. Because when y'all looked at me, you knew I need help. And y'all grabbed them women, grab me. And they said, uh-uh, leave her alone. Get away from her. Get away from her. She's a newcomer. Leave her alone. Let her get sober. So, if you see a newcomer, don't ignore her. Try to share the message. We can't control anything, but we try to pass it on. Try to help look out for each other as best we can without trying to be God in control. You know what I'm trying to say? And so it works a day at a time. So then Peggy, you know, retired. She went to Florida. And then I got the sponsor that I had now, so I've been having for over the last 12 years, Gene H. from the St. Albans Group in New York City, a male sponsor. And I love my sponsor. My sponsor took me through the 12 steps and 12 traditions. I would meet him every 2 weeks out in Queens, and I would have to read the step in the big book and read it in the 12 and 12 and read the pamphlets and answer questions. What does the step mean to me? What does it ask me to practice? How does it help me to stay sober? I was working, baby. Because, see, I came in here and I stayed here long enough to find out, you only can stay here so long on don't drink and make meetings, and then you start going crazy because, you know, we get crazier without a drink than with a drink. Because now the booze is gone. What am I going to do? All those defensive characters that I had while I was drinking and that I drank to keep down, now they magnify without a drink. I better do something about the disease of alcoholism before it does something to me. Now, I could drink or go crazy or kill someone or be killed or end up in some bizarre situation and still be acting drunk. That's why I need the program of recovery. And so I began to find out about Margaretta, about me. Not you, me. My sponsor, Gene, is the type of sponsor. See, when I call Gene, I can't have no third persons in the conversation. The only person I can talk about is me. I cannot gossip or anything. Because anytime I want to talk about you, I don't want to look at me. And I got to keep looking at me because the disease of alcoholism is always trying to get me, not you. So I got to keep the focus on me. That means that you are relieved. You are dismissed in terms of that stuff. I got to be working on me. What's going on with you, Margaretta? And then my sponsor told me, listen, you got to be willing to make a decision to turn your life and will up to the care of God. What? Make a decision to turn your life and will up to the care of God. And this is all I would get. Make a decision, turn your life and will up to the care of God. You know, and he just drilled it. He would say, Margaretta, keep going to your higher power. Keep getting into the practice. And he would always say, your higher power wants to work. He wants to work. Give it up to him. Give your higher power something to do. And I found out that my higher power is like a jealous lover. He wants all my attention. And when I don't give my higher power my attention, all hell breaks loose in my head. I mean, we can all keep the outside going. It's no biggie. To go to work, come home, pay a bill, now to be sober, da-da-da-da-da-da-da, go to school, whatever you want, da-da-da-da, that's easy. The hard stuff is getting along with me up in my head. I am my problem. The disease of alcoholism centers mainly in my mind. It is my stinking thinking that kept me drinking. It's my stinking thinking that keeps me dis at ease with myself one day at a time. If I'm not willing to turn my life and will over to the care of God, I am screwed. I cannot make me better. And I've tried. I know, come on now. We all can testify on this one now. How have we tried to make ourselves better? Okay, that's how we're going to do this now. Okay, we're going to go back to school. We're going to get a better position. We're going to get some promotions. We're going to buy a house. We're going to do this. We're going to get another apartment. We're going to get a car. We're going to send the children here. We're going to do that. We're going to travel. We're going to do this. We're going to do that. I'm going to get another pair of black shoes that I don't need. Cram it in, baby. Cram it in. Now I'm just expressing myself through stuff. I'm still not letting go and letting God. And so it comes a point where one more thing. Because, you know, as an alcoholic, especially as a former black Marilyn Monroe, it's always about appearing that everything is fabulous. So everything's got to be fabulous. Everything I do is geared for me to be fabulous. So you can know and say, my God, she's fabulous. Self-centered to the extreme, we know that. But it doesn't work. I get one more thing, and I'm still have that dis-at-ease with myself. I'm still like, that's not it. What is it, God? Oh, God. And that's it, God. What's wrong now? I cannot. And my sponsor taught me, Margaret, you might as well come on here and grow up, because we don't have a crib your size here in AA. I found out the alcoholic must grow up. Oh, God. I remember when I first came around the first few years, you know, my teenage daughter then, you know, I still had kind of like my Marilyn Monroe look going on, you know. So, you know, it had been tapered, but, you know, I'm still like into my body and stuff. And I remember one day like primping in the mirror, like, it ain't right. You know, and she said, Mommy, are you trying to look like me? Oh, my God. I was like, oh, God, she's right. I'm still trying to not grow up. And in AA, we surrender things that we must surrender. And I tell you, we all have areas in our lives where it's hard. Getting older has been, well, until I was willing to let go, it was just torturous. Oh, my God. I've been fabulous all my life. How can it be? Other people get older, not me. You know, this sort of self-centeredness and this sort of ego going on. Oh, my God. I've been very sick. But y'all been helping me get better. And, you know, after about two years, my husband and I we split up. He was still active, and I, you know, he went on to do what he had to do, and I went on about staying sober and the three children and a day at a time and trying to do the right thing. And I began to date, and it was a fiasco. Horrible. Nothing ever worked out. And I couldn't figure out why. So I would just go back to school, do something, eat another cupcake, I don't know, shit, do something. Never worked out. Now, I had to put that husband out of my mind, because, you know, hey, I want another one anyway. Do you know, about a year ago, God put that man back in my life? Not me, because I was ready for another one. God put that man back in my life. And pay attention when things don't work out. God be talking. Pay attention. All the time I was out there seeking and searching and looking and booping and bumping and all that sort of stuff and running to the gym to be perfect and having the best wardrobe. Oh, my God, my wardrobe was drop dead. I had every outfit for every occasion, for every look, for every body size where I would be. I had everything going for me. You know, my fat days, my skinny days. Oh, I was working, baby. I decorated my home fabulous. Wait, oh, my God, it was a trap, really. I remember once this guy, he was a potential. And he came to my house, and he looked at this, you know, went by the bedroom, of course, because I got to have everything perfect. And he walked by, and he said, this is a trap. See, I keep coming, though. I was trying and every time I try and don't let God do, I lose. So finally, as I said, God put this man back in my life. And once I settled back into that, I began to have the peace that passes all understanding. I found out that I have to, through prayer and meditation, be willing to commune with my higher power, universal spirit, good, or all these directions, whatever you want to call it. I must try to seek knowledge of his will or her will and be have the courage to carry it out. I come into AA and I found out where I've been a coward. I've been a coward in so many areas of my life. And it really hurt to find that out when my exterior was so goddamn fabulous. That I had been a coward in so many areas. I had been a coward in my relationships. I had been a coward to speak up when I needed to speak up. Anything to keep you liking me. But it's been a journey a day at a time. And where I'm at today, me and the husband, we're working it through. And it's been difficult. Lately, it's been extremely difficult. Extremely painful. Because the wreckage of the past has to be dealt with. And the willingness to grow together and grow individually also. But the miracle that I need to share about all that is that I'm not running away. I'm sticking and I'm staying. Don't panic when you get a great big something in your life that you don't know and you get confused about, because we're going to have times of confusion. We're going to have times where, baby, you're going to be going on the up and down at the same time and in the same elevator. It's going to be torturous at times. The emotional, do I have any more time for that? A little bit, okay. Sometimes the emotional upheaval is like, oh my God, can I sign up for the mental institution for a little break right now? Please, somebody, I want a break from all this emotional turmoil. Don't panic when that happens. Just keep on going for it. Just keep on being willing to let go and let God and change. And believe me, things do change and they do get better. Or if they don't get better, I have the serenity to accept the things that I cannot change. And that's Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, several months ago, my husband, he called me and he said, baby, on your way home from the store, on your way home from work, why don't you stop? Can you stop by just the corner store and pick up some water and some bananas? I said, that's too much for me. That's too much. I can't handle that. No. That's the disease, right? I hung up the phone. And then because of the program, I said, now come on. You know that ain't nice. You being all selfish and self-centered again. Come on now, let go and let God. You can do this. Now all I want you to do is go in the store now. All I want you to do now, just walk into the store. Go ahead, walk into the store, girl. You can do it. You can do it. Go in that store and get that water. That is AA. We can go to the store now. I could not do those sort of things before. I would have a fabulous home and a fabulous wardrobe, but I would have no food in my house because going to the supermarket was just too much for me. It was like stuff that you don't really need to be bothered with, like food, you know. And so y'all been healing me, helping me heal a day at a time. I want to say how important it is to not let resentments ruin us. I know that I've had a few major resentments in recovery, and I'm telling you, they can really wipe you out. Two of my resentments ended me up in the doctor's office with headaches. And the doctor, now this is my story, so nobody get offended. Please. I walked to the doctor, so I told the doctor, yeah, I got this headache, and she said, well, let me give you a little bit of Prozac. I said, wait a minute, doc. I know what the problem is. I got a resentment I need to let go and let God. I'll see you later. Now, anybody who has to take medication, do what you got to do. I'm just saying what my experience was, and this is where resentment can take me. Resentments are deadly. They're all built in fear. All my bad feelings, all my dis-ease with myself, all that is built, the foundation of all of it is fear. What am I afraid of? And I come in and I found out that I'm afraid to live. I'm afraid sometimes to let the good stuff in. I'd rather hold on to the bad because I know what that is, and rather than to let the good in what I don't even think. But I need to do that and keep working with that. So you all been showing me and loving me and pointing the way and sharing your stories. And I hear your experience, strength, and hope. And I totally identify. And you help me navigate my mind through this maze and through alcoholism. And for that, I am so grateful. So we come in here. We stay. We make those business meetings. We help the newcomer so they don't take over. We must help the newcomer. Because if we don't pass on the program of recovery, the newcomer will take over and might want to put us out. So we pass on 12 steps, 12 traditions. We do service. Service is so important. My friend here, Jan, talks about service so much, and I understand. See, when I get locked up into me, the only way that I can get out of me is to act my way out a lot of times with service, just making myself available. And then I get the peace that passes all understanding. And that's really what I'm seeking. I'm really not seeking money, property, and prestige. I ain't saying I don't want it. But I'm really not seeking money, property, and prestige. What I'm really seeking is the peace that passes all understanding. I'm seeking peace in my mind. And from the peace in my mind, I'll get the peace in my body. That's what I'm truly seeking. And the only way out of this, the only way out, is the 12 steps and 12 traditions of Alcoholics Anonymous. That's the only thing I have found that worked. Because before I got to AA, I had tried many other things. I had went to church and went into the bathroom of the church and took a swig. I had tried chanting. I had tried a little bit of some therapy. I had tried relationships. I tried a lot of stuff, but it didn't work. It just didn't work. But I've come into AA, and AA has been consistent for me all these years. So Alcoholics Anonymous works. If you're holding on to anything, if you got any kind of secrets that you're holding on to, please give them up. But wait a minute. Give them up to a closed mouth person if you can. But no matter what happens, we got to accept it. If it comes back the way you don't want, we still got to let go and let God. Because my peace of mind is not contingent on other people's behavior, what other people think, say, or do. My peace of mind is contingent on my willingness to let go and let God, to turn my life and will over to the care of God. So that's the hit. That's the real deal. So even if you do something to piss me off, even if you do something, step on my toe, and I didn't do anything to you, even if you do that, I have a responsibility not to take what you did, which maybe was a wrong, and re-injure myself with it with a resentment. That's Alcoholics Anonymous. All right? I want to let you know that I love you. Let's keep coming back. Keep passing it on. Keep letting go and letting God. And it absolutely does work. And I'm going to look forward to seeing y'all in 5 more years. Where are we going? Texas! Thank you!
Greta, you are fabulous, inside, outside. You know, I don't know about other cultures, but I know in America that we have often done an injustice to our young women growing up, and many of us came to AA with little regard for other women. I mean, we just really had very little trust. Certainly I did. I really couldn't enjoy the success of anyone. It's like, I remember one time I was running for office and my son was helping me rehearse and we're talking and I looked down and I said, well, wait a minute, do these pantyhose go with this dress? And he's like, Mother, we're talking taxes here. And I said, no, you don't get it. This is a women's group. And they'll leave and they'll think, oh, she's very smart. But do you see that outfit? You know? I mean, so this is, you know, we make those judgments. Now, in sobriety, the great gift that I've gotten is to really relish the success of women and not put the caveat on it, not put the, you know, she's wonderful, but I just happen to know a little something about her that you don't know kind of thing, which I was so prone to do. And I had no joy in other women's sobriety or success or happiness because somehow it diminished me. And I don't understand that, really.
as much as I've studied it, I still don't get it, but it was real. And it's gone. You know, it's been lifted. And now when I think AA, I think women. I think about my sister-in-law, Roberta, and I think about Linda, and I think about Dawn, and I think about so many women, Susan, who have impacted my life. And when I'm in a tough spot, what I can do is just play a montage of their faces. I can just do that. They're just there for me. And I know they are. I don't have to touch them physically or talk to them. They're just part of, they've created the life I have now. And they won't let me down, and they're true, and they're honorable, and they're all the things that I want to be, so I can just pull from them. And it's a great thing that isn't really promised in the book. It doesn't really talk about the relationship that you may develop and the sisterhood that can come from sobriety. But for me, it's very real, and since Fran's death, it's been so powerful for me to know that there are people who just, someone said, "Oh, you know, you're living my worst nightmare. When I look at you and I think of my own life and how will I get along without my husband?" And she said, "But you're doing it." So watching you, she said, "You know, it's still a nightmare, but I see that it's possible to traverse that." And it really is true. And so I get this great joy. And looking at this room, and there are honorable men scattered throughout. I see them, you know, but overwhelmingly, you know, the testosterone level is low in this room. And the great hormonal power that's in here is just staggering to be receiving it. It's fabulous. So our next treat is already a feast for the eyes, the gorgeous Yolanda.
First, the blessing. All honor and glory to my higher power, the Creator. I ask my spirit guides to be with me and my ancestors to step forth.
Hi, I'm Yolanda, and I'm definitely an alcoholic. You guys are just beautiful. There's hundreds of thousands of us out there, and I just love it. I hope I look beautiful, too. I wear this regalia in honor of my mother. She's Aztec from the Huastecan tribe, clan of the snake. And my father is Yaqui from the Deer Clan people. His last living relative on reservation was the Guadalupe Reservation in Arizona. So, thank you. I wanted to thank Doug R. from Central AA for this honor. This is really a mountaintop experience for me. And Larry N., the former president for the Native American General Service Office, for this time and this honor and his encouragement. And Don W. for the Sacred Eagle Feather and his family, who is the general manager of NIA GSO. The Fraternal Spiritualistic Church, of which I am a member, Reverend Milling Landis, who's been an instrumental person who has helped me find my path and my journey once again in that congregation. And to all the lovely women and men who I jacuzzi with last night and the night before. They said they would be here. We're half naked in the hot water and it's so fun. We come from the foothills, way, way deep, deep, deep in the southern part of California. And we ran around barefooted. And we played with rocks and we became really good rock throwers. There was no drinking in those little tiny years of mine. And one day a uniformed man came up on the land and he said it was time for these children to start school. So our nearest neighbor was 12 miles away, an older elder who was good friends with my grandmother. So she comes on her cart, governed by a mule, and she sits with my grandmother through the wee hours of the night. And she tells my grandmother, don't leave these sacred hills. Don't go into town, into the cities, for there is a plague. It will change your blood and poison it and will cause you separation. But we left because we all had to start school, the littler ones. And we went down into town. And about in the 50s, in the early 50s, when I'm about 7, 8 years old, the youngest uncle, because we all lived together, came home drunk. And I could hear through the wall my grandmother sobbing and crying. And it spread through the family like wildfire. Everybody started getting drunk. The uncles all joined different branches of the service, the Marines, the Air Force, the Army, the Navy, and they would come home on leave, and they would all get drunk, and there'd be big fights going on. Us littler kids were running around crazy around the house that time, and I got a hold of some liquor. I was nearly 9 years old, and four of us cousins ran outside, and we had a big tumbler, and I gave it to my brother, and he took a great big swallow, and he swished it around, and he spit it out, and he says, this tastes like fire, the term fire water then. And then he handed it to my cousin, and after that display, she smelled it, and just decided to pass it on. And that cousin took a little tiny drink and said she never wanted any more. And I got all the rest of it. That was a real good deal. I got drunk. I got back into the house. I went into my grandmother's bedroom where no one was allowed to go into. I climbed up on her bed. She had a beautiful animal skin on top of her bed. And I passed out, and it felt so nice on my skin. My father came in, and he hugged me, and he embraced me, and he tended to be kind of abusive with me. I was the oldest, and I could feel the love for my father in that little drunken state little girl, and I connected the two. Even though my parents are Indian, they had 100% alcoholic in me. I grew up and I owned my own bar. I'm 19 years old, I have 2 children, and I own a bar. I couldn't even drink in the bar because I wasn't old enough. So my husband was drinking in the bar, and two things I wanted when I was 21, I wanted to vote and I wanted to drink in my own bar. And when I got to be 21, that's just what I did. And I was the bar mistress there. My husband started womanizing and going to other bars and drinking. You know how we do. So I decided I'm on strike. I would close that bar down early, and I would pick people out that I liked. You stay, you stay, you and you stay. Always the voluptuous women and always the seemingly stocky guys. Because part of the criteria was that after that bar closed down and we started to drink, you had to get naked. I don't know why nudity and drinking always went hand in hand with me. I'm sober now and I'm embarrassed to wear a bathing suit. So the pool game started, you know, and I was a married woman, so I never completely stripped after all. And you know, I went from the waist up. Topless was very popular then. And these guys would start shooting pool, and I don't know why men have to open their legs so big to bend over the tables to shoot. And from the behind, they look like bulls in a pasture. The women bent over with their voluptuous stuff going on, and they were all over the table. So we had a very good time. It did create a separation, finally, between my husband and I. All kinds of wild things were going on. I decided not to drink in my own bar anymore. I started drinking in other bars. It's funny, these titles, the bars, you know, I drank in a place called the Stagecoach. And I'd come out of there like I'd get hit by the team. The sweet inspiration. Two homicides within a week in the alley. So then I decided to go to another bar called Kavanaugh's. Now, I had moved again, and I lived near around Van Nuys, right there where the police station was. I figured I'd go to Kavanaugh's because that's where all the DAs and the investigators and the police, that's where they all drank. That's where they all hang out. And I was in there, and I was all dressed up, thinking I was really beautiful. And a couple of police officers took me out, and they raped me. And I knew then that as a drunken woman, I had no rights. I was Indian, and I was already ashamed. I was raped, and I was ashamed. And I was drunk, and I lost all my rights. I never told anybody about that. Even after I came into AA, it took a long time for me to say that. I was a child of incest. That uncle, that sweet little innocent uncle that first came home drunk in the early 50s, I was incested by him. And so that already kind of unbalanced me. But when I went and got attacked by these police officers, well, then that really turned my head around. I stayed locked up at home, and I drank and drank and drank at home. Now I'm doing suicidal drinking. My life wasn't working. I hit bottom, and I came back to San Diego. My mother rented me an apartment, and I continued to drink. She bought me cute little clothes, and I went down into the valley, and I was drinking down there pretty heavily, pretty heavily. And I was not a saint. You know, there was people that I would run off with from time to time. There was this delegate, a U.S. delegate, that kind of was in masochistic, I guess you call it. You know, when you like to get beat up, sort of. Well, that was really good for me. I had a lot of frustration against men. It started out innocently enough. We were just jumping. There was a twin bed, so we were jumping back and forth at first. And I took a belt, and while he was jumping this way and me that way, I smacked him. And he liked it. By the time it was all over, we never had sex. He was beat up. But I felt so much better. I found myself an older man. He was 26 years older than myself. And the deal, here was the deal, that I would hang on his arm and he would buy me all the liquor I wanted, took me to the really fancy places in San Diego, but he had a prostate problem. And I thought, great. Less wear and tear on my body. And I could drink all that I wanted. And all I had to do was hang on his arm so people would get the idea that we were active. One morning I woke up and reaching over for what was left of the wine, he's crying over my bed. I had an epitome, or I think that's what it's called, where he was looking down on me and I thought, gosh, it feels like I'm laying in a coffin. And I'm looking up and he's crying and he says, Yolanda, I can't be your friend anymore. And I thought, darn it. He says, you're going to wind up on the Bowery, which is some kind of skid row in New York. But we weren't in New York, so it didn't make any sense. What did my drinking have to do with New York? He said, if you had a chance to quit drinking, would you? And I thought a couple of seconds and said, why? You don't have to be my friend, but can you come around sometimes? And he says, if you had a chance to go to Alcoholics Anonymous, would you go? And I said, what do they do there? He says, they don't drink. And I was pretty sick, and I was hungover, and I said, okay, but I want to go right now before I change my mind. So in those years, I was one of 38% that came in on a phone book, but I never made the call. And he took me to my first meeting and of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I was embarrassed, and I was ashamed. We had Marilyn Monroe over here. I was Zsa Gabor. Most definitely. I didn't want anyone to recognize me. I always thought I was a movie star. I had made a few commercials, and I had lived in Hollywood, and I didn't want to be recognized. So I wore a beautiful red pleated dress, little crystal shoes, shiny crystal little earrings, and a Zsa Gabor wig. I stepped into Alcoholics Anonymous. Everybody turned around, and their mouths were wide open, gasping, and I was open for autographs. I thought, darn it, they know who I am. I sat down and they said, is there anyone here with less than 30 days of sobriety? And I knew they were talking about me. I had never been stopped for a sobriety test. I've never experienced jail. I've never had a tattoo yet. So I raised my hand half willingly and said, my name is Yolanda, and I think I drink too much. And all the melon heads, yay, and they start clapping. And I looked around, I said, shiny-eyed melon heads, all of you. And today I stand before you a shiny-eyed melon head. The only difference is I got feathers coming out of mine. At 30 days of sobriety, I'm over there standing at the coffee machine because I really do want to remain invisible. And the funniest part about it is that's probably the most active part of the room is the coffee area. And this little old-timer, a Chihuahuan Indian, the only other one in the meeting, came up and introduced himself. And I had a little bit over 30 days. A woman was getting a two-year cake. And he asked me, Yolanda, honey, what do you think about that woman getting a two-year cake? Whew. And I looked at him. I said, gee, you really want to know? So, yeah, honey, what do you think about that woman getting a two-year cake? I said, well, I think she's going to the bathroom and taking a couple of nips and a few zingers, and she's a liar. Then I kind of hung on real tight to my coffee styrofoam cup going into a crunch, wondering if that was the wrong answer. And he says, honey, is that what you think? Yes, that's what I think. Well, honey, I'll tell you what we're going to do. We'll get a little cake. We'll get a little wine. We'll go in the alley. We'll have a little cake. And we'll have a little wine. And I was shocked. Now, it was okay for me to throw away my Sprite, but this little guy, Manny, wore every drink, every cigarette, all over. There's lines on his face. And I said, no, no, no. You cannot throw your sobriety away. And he goes, that's right, honey. You keep coming back. He self-appointed himself my spiritual advisor. He talked about the higher power all the time. And, you know, he could tell when I was getting up to here with it, because when I turned, I'd be driving the car, and I'd turn to look at him, and he'd just point up. He'd stop talking now. He'd just point up. I told him I'm not having any fun. How do these people have fun? You can't go to a ball game and have a beer. How do you eat pizza or spaghetti without wine? You can't even eat. I mean, water has no flavor. What do you do? At 8 months of sobriety, he took me to a Cinco de Mayo celebration in Old Town San Diego. And he bought me a hot tamale. A real hot tamale. And he sat me under a big oak tree, and I said to him in an honest way, I want a beer. Honey, you really want a beer? Yes, I do. I'm burning up. He says, you sit right here. I'll be right back. And he's gone, and it seems like he's gone a long time. And he comes back with those peripheral little paper bags, really cute ones that you're supposed to hide your liquor in. And he hands it to me. He says, you want a drink, honey? Here. So I get a hold of it, and I'm thinking, do I really want to throw away my sobriety? Boy, this tamale's hot in my mouth. Do I really want to just give it all up? I've worked so hard. I hold on to the can, and I pop it open. I hear it pop open. And I said, oh, what the hell? And I took a great big drink of it. It was a beer, all right. A root beer. Bad associations will spoil useful habits. You have to stay with the winners in this program. He called me a squirrel head and that we needed to go to a meeting right now. So we went down into the valley to the Pathfinders, and he pointed me right out, no hesitation. This squirrel head right here wanted to throw her sobriety away. I was embarrassed. Time passed, and now I have 4 years of sobriety, and I thought I was sponsoring women. You know, I wasn't really taking them through the steps or the 12 and 12 or anything like that. I thought I was sponsoring by telling them, do anything you want, just use your condoms. And I OD'd on AA. I had enough of it. I wound up in a stress center in Chula Vista, California. And I went in there and I told him, look, I'm OD'd on AA. I've read the book. I understand the steps and the writing and the sponsor stuff. I really don't want to hear any more about it. I just need to rest. I became the activities director there. They didn't have a swimming pool, but I made all the participants, you know, especially the ones that would rock back and forth, slapping their face. I'm in a loony bin, and I'm 4 years sober now. You know, take off their clothes to their underwear and bras if you're a woman, except for the guy who likes to wear the bras. And I went out and I turned down the great big sprinklers. It was a big yard. I said, we are going through the Mexican swimming pool. And they started running back and forth in this pool, which were sprinklers. And the counselors had a big bay window right overlooking. And they knew it was my idea. I had a real good time there. I never understood the Bradshaw tapes. And then one day they brought in a woman into my room. She was pretty beat up. They found her in Mexico, in Tijuana. And she was raped and beat up and really left for dead. And they had her in the stress center. And we started to talk, or she started to talk to me, because I didn't want to talk to any of them. Because I knew I was in the loony bin, and I figured energy attracts energy, but if I stay to myself, maybe they won't think I'm part of them. And she started telling me that she was drinking too much and carrying on, and the light went on. Aha. And then I started giving her my testimony in Alcoholics Anonymous. And then I was the one of all of those people that was allowed to sign out to go to meetings. Now, I had not wanted to go before, but now I'm going to take somebody. So I'm going to sign out and take her to a meeting. And the bottom line here is that it states for us in the book, when all else fails, that means the book, the sponsor, the meetings, the people, the stories. You know, after so many years, you think you're awful thirsty by now, and you become a connoisseur of flavored waters. When all else fails, work intently with another alcoholic. God bless. God bless us. So I started really working with this young lady and really doing the steps and really getting into the 12 and 12. And surprisingly, only 2% of all of us members in Alcoholics Anonymous know the 12 and 12. So let's pick up those numbers, kids. And that lady's sober today. She's sober and she travels the United States giving talks. And it's always part of listen to the message, don't judge the messenger. Why was I in this loony bin? Sometimes my higher power works divine designs, things of which I will never understand, things that allow me to accept where I'm at and who I am. I came into Alcoholics Anonymous with a lot of issues. I was embarrassed to be Indian. I found it to be very prejudiced. I found it harder to be white. And it was very difficult to get jobs. I talked funny. I didn't speak like other people. When I started school, I didn't even know English. And I couldn't speak my language in school. It started very young. And today I stand before you in my mother's regalia because I am responsible. I am a member of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I am a woman of color. You know, I'm grateful for that. We are a very proud people, and I just want to go through this real quick. I have brothers. You know, one of them, all of them, all three of my brothers were Vietnam veterans. And when they came back, one of my brothers had a horrendous fight with my mother. And he was drinking far too much. There was the war in us growing up, and then the alcohol. And it took me back to the old elder who said that our blood would be poisoned and it would cause separation. He left, and he separated himself. 30 years later, my mother's reading the paper. It's Easter morning, and she reads that her son is dead. So we go through the night quickly to see if it's true, because I had located him 4 years earlier, and he said it was too late to come home. And it was true. My mother got so sick. That's not to say that she was already not sick. She fell into Alzheimer's. It's easier for her to deal with things that way. She still knows who I am, and she still knows who we are as a family, but she can't remember things in 5 minutes or 10. So the headpiece is my mother, and the tribe puts the feathers in. And when I got to go to an Indian meeting and hear the drums, they were the sound of my heart, and they welcomed me back to the tribe. They welcomed me back, the earth people, and the sky people, and the deer people, and my mother's clan. And today, my home group is Medicine Wheel. Our young people are dying faster than our elders. So it's real important for us to step up on our sovereign lands and our reservations, and to put the hand of AA out there for us, because our culture is so different from the Europeans that my spiritual advisor says, Yolanda, honey, you suffer from a white man disease. You need a white man cure. May God bless you and keep you, and know that there are thousands of us here today of many languages and many colors, and all you have to do is smile, because in a smile, you speak all languages. God bless you all.
Thank you. Thank you, Yolanda. So you've heard two wonderful women. Any one of you could be up here because all our stories are magical and marvelous. And we're just so grateful that you came to share this afternoon with us. And maybe I always like to finish when I'm talking with Marty Mann, the woman who was so powerful for all of us, who used to close by saying, "I'm not the woman I ought to be. I'm not the woman I want to be, but because of AA, I'm not the woman I used to be." So if you would like to join me now, we will close with the Serenity Prayer. And thank you again. You are a sight for eyes to behold. I'm so honored to have been part of this today. Thank you.